Happy New Year. It's a little late, I know. I'm just arriving back in Santa Cruz this year. So I haven't seen a lot of you for a while. It seems like it's been a while when you go somewhere else. As many of you know, I was in Nepal. I went to visit my partner, Shoho, who's living over there in Kathmandu, studying Buddhism. So I mainly went to visit her, and I've been to Nepal a few times before and thought, it's nice to go there, but, you know, I wouldn't necessarily want to go if she wasn't there. It's like, it wasn't that long ago I was there. So I, she was like, well, what should we plan? Should I plan all kinds of, excursions around the country? And I'm like, doesn't matter to me. We can just sit around your place for the month. Just, you know, be together. But of course, we went and explored around. And kind of maybe unexpectedly, or somewhat expectedly, it really struck me, being in that kind of a place, the impact of practice, the sense of Dharma and practice kind of pervading the culture is really like, it's very refreshing and inspiring. Hard to say, you know, exactly what it is, but, it's a Buddhist country, Buddhist and Hindu country, and I think unique, Nepal is unique in that Buddhism and Hinduism are all kind of blended together. People don't consider themselves one or the other. They're kind of like both. I mean, maybe people specialize a little bit, but they don't distinguish so much. Sometimes temples, you can't even quite tell. It's like, maybe it was a Buddhist temple and it has become kind of like sort of Hindu. It's like, is Shiva the main thing, or is it a Buddhist Vajrayogini or something? You know, especially in Tantra is, has its roots in both Hinduism and Buddhism, which means all these different deities, basically. Very complex system. And there's lots of overlap, and of course each one has to have its own unique way, but they're often very indistinguishable. They influence each other a lot. And then the area where Shoho lives is really a Tibetan area that was, become a kind of Tibetan settlement in more recent times. So, it's probably the majority of people in that neighborhood or, section of Kathmandu are Tibetan. And the Tibetans, so much of their identity is all wrapped up in Buddhism. And it may be that partly because they're displaced from their country, that's keeping their cultural identity alive. But you really feel their practice pervading their lives, at least in the way that it appears. Sometimes it's hard to know what's going on, actually, how they understand the practice, but they're expressing it outwardly, like all over the place. I mean, many, many monks and nuns walking around in robes. Sometimes it even seems like maybe half the people. It's probably not quite half, but many, many people that are keeping that kind of formal practice life alive in the many, many monasteries and temples. like their lives aren't that different. It's not like the monks and nuns are like secluded in the monastery. They're just completely in the town, and you know, maybe they're not running the stores, but they're shopping there, and they're just part of the daily life of the town. Often, you know, sitting out on the sidewalk, you know, playing chess or something with the Nepali shop owner, things like that. It's just part of the people. And lots of great things, experiences there. Maybe a highlight for me was getting to do a retreat with Sokni Rinpoche, who's my main Tibetan teacher. I've done quite a few retreats in America with, and I was hoping he would be there. He travels around the world so much, and he wasn't for most, but just at the end, he came back, and actually his Western students over there asked him if he could do a Dzogchen retreat. And of course he said sure, and so it ended up being this whole 3-day retreat, very wonderful to practice with him and his group of students who live over there, very like loosely. He doesn't have like a practice place really there, so it's just people practicing, and when he does something, they all kind of hear about it somehow, and went up to the mountains outside the city to his father, who was a great teacher, has a hermitage up in the mountains. Now it's a nuns community. So just a different feeling to do a retreat like that with him in his kind of home country in the Tibetan temple. It's all, of course, everything's kind of funky. It's like when I first came back and stepped into the Zendo, something seemed off because everything's so like clean and new looking. Things are, of course, they're very, very beautiful, ornate temples with lots of stuff, and you know, the walls are completely covered with murals of Buddhas and huge, you know, 10-foot tall statues of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but everything's all kind of like a little raggedy, all sort of falling apart, all the paint's coming off, and there's nobody really cleans it so much. So it's almost this, the contrast of the American practice places are, they're very well kept, but they're not so ornate. I think part of the ornate decoration of these places is like a kind of devotional way to both make offerings to Buddhas and make Buddhas to make offerings to. And so the sense of devotion in that culture is very strong. So just an image can describe a little bit of the daily life around this stupa. You know, stupa is like a kind of reliquary mound, like, you know, with Buddha's relics in it. So supposedly this stupa had the relics of Kashyapa Buddha, one of the 7 ancient Buddhas. How that works, we don't know. But, you know, I think it's, you know, prehistory when this stupa arose in this valley, and very large, and it's been added to and rebuilt over all the centuries. And it's kind of the center of this area called Bodhnath, where Shoho lives, the Tibetan area. And it's kind of like the people in the town, everybody basically relates to the stupa as like the center of the town. And it is, it's a very dominant structure. It takes maybe 10 minutes to walk all the way around it. So everywhere you are, if you're, you know, second floor above in any building, you see from miles away, you can see this giant stupa. And there's stores and temples all around it. Everything's sort of built circular around in concentric circles. So it really is kind of the center of the town. And people really relate to it, though. It's not like, I don't know, like the clock tower here is kind of like a central landmark of Santa Cruz, but people don't really relate to it. It's just a marker. But this is like, it's a very relational practice kind of place. And when you first, all these winding streets, you first, you can approach it from many different streets, and you first go around a corner into view of the stupa. People, the custom is to like stop and just kind of like take in the view and make a kind of a aspiration, prayer or vow or take refuge. It's kind of nice, you know, you're walking along, you're talking with somebody, and then at first it was a little like, what's going on? I'd be talking and the person would stop. I'm like, oh, it's the stupa now. We got to stop and bow and, you know, it's like a moment of practice. And likewise, when you're leaving that area around the stupa and your last view of it, you turn back and you stop and bow and make a little dedication or something. So it's it had that function. And then one of the main practices around stupas is circumambulating them, walking around them. And that's the main thing that was, you really see people basically all day. It's always clockwise around a stupa, so you couldn't, basically this long kind of street, if you had to go to a store or something, you know, that would be like a couple hundred feet that way, you'd have to walk all around the stupa the other way because you couldn't go against the clockwise flow. You know, during the middle of the day, there was always, you know, probably be like maybe 100 people minimum walking around. But then what I started thinking of as rush hour was like in the mornings, you know, I just kind of early morning, I think people like on their way to work. This is mostly lay people. You know, there were definitely monks and nuns too walking around, but mostly lay people. And I think a lot of it was just people who lived and worked and had their lives in the area. That would be their morning practice, is that you'd see the flow start to just increase until it was like, you know, huge, like you couldn't, you know, the street from the stupa to the nearest stores, maybe 50 feet, and it would be like, maybe most of that would be filled with like solid people for this 10 minute walk around. And again, at sunset at the end of the day, people walking around, almost everybody had a mala, so be reciting mantras and counting. And, you know, pretty informal, though. Some fast, some slow, some carrying kids, some walking with their kids. Very, very old people, everyone have to walk around them because they'd just be hobbling around. Some would be prostrating around, you know, put like wooden hand, things strapped on there so you could go down on the dirty ground again and again. And I think the people who were doing it long term all day or multiple days would have this whole kind of like maybe leather apron so you could just, because your prostrations are flat out, your whole body. So people are walking fast around them and they're slowly making their way around prostration. And maybe the ones who thought that even that was too kind of rushed, they would stop and face the stupa and do a prostration, take one side step to the left and do another prostration facing the stupa. So they'd go even slower. And, you know, teenagers, you know, I don't know if anyone was ever listening to their iPod, but sometimes people would be talking but you're still, just by going around the stupa, you're, according to the ancient teachings, you're, you know, accumulating merit here, and you're relating to Buddha. It's like it's an intentional practice, even though it's not much, and it's maybe a lot of these people have never done sitting meditation, but it's devotional practice. Making offerings to the stupa, incense. It's nice because it was just, it didn't belong to any temple because it's the center of everything. So everyone, I mean, I'm sure there's people who are in charge of keeping it up, and you might have seen pictures of this stupa. It's unique to Nepal. They have up on the top, it's got these eyes, Buddha eyes, which are, you know, if you see a person up there, which occasionally would be people repainting, they're probably constantly repainting the eyes, and the eye is, you know, probably 10 feet across when there's a person next to it. But, you know, candles, there's all these little alcoves and constantly people putting in candles and incense, and people have their unique things, you know, their sort of trademark practices. There's one particular guy who I remember from 3 years ago, same guy. It's just his thing. I don't know. It's not really all day, but it's maybe every day. You know, big incense urn, you know, kind of swinging on a chain, and tons of smoke, just fragrant smoke, just pouring out, and he's walking around there. See, he was like the big incenser guy. And then they had in the front this kind of stand that was just, must have been some kind of coals or something under there, but you never saw what was under because it was just mounds of incense powders and herbs and twigs, and of course many, many shops with just giant barrels of all kinds of aromatic things that you buy to offer there, and just be like overflowing piles of stuff falling onto the ground, and people would kind of like congregate around this sort of incense stand and you know, incense their malas or get a new Buddha statue or something. You can go there and incense it with the smoke. And it's completely lined with prayer wheels, so there's like all the mantras and prayers inside the wheels. I'm sure you've seen this. I think it's unique to Tibetan Buddhism, the wheels and prayer flags, right? The idea is that if something's moving, it's like sending out the energy of that mantra or prayer to the world just by moving. So it's an offering to hang the flags and let the wind carry the prayers around. So from the top of the stupa down, just thousands and thousands of prayer flags constantly getting taken down and new ones getting put up, or the whole thing would be completely buried in flags. And the wheels are all the way around, so a thousand or so of these wheels about this big. And so as you walk, you can spin them. And then you go into this, in the gate, into the more central area of the stupa, and then there's the big prayer wheels, the big 10-foot high ones, where you have to like, you barely turn it, it's very slowly, if it's not moving, to get some momentum going, with usually hooked up to little bells, and so that makes sound, and then all kinds of bells to ring, and going through the different passageways, and these whole room, like maybe almost the size of the Zendo, completely filled with, you know, those little butter lamps, which you pay a few rupees to light the lamp as an offering. And they're constantly, as they burn out, they have huge piles of them where they're like, the ones that are burnt out, they're just kind of throwing them in a bin. They're, you know, these nice brass lamps, and somebody else is cleaning them all out and getting them ready for the next round of offering. And then, of course, people bring their own, and then water bowls. You offer water to Buddhas. So bowls like this big, again, thousands maybe, all around the edges of the stupa that kind of just go with the stupa. And I think there's particular people, but it takes like a huge group of people to fill these every day and then pour them out at the end of the day with special saffron water. And you see a whole group of 20 or 30 people just drying the bowls at the end of the day, putting them all away, get them ready for the morning. And then you go down another little passageway, and there's a little kind of opening. Kind of, this is inside the stupa walls now, where it's like it's a little bit wider, and that's the prostration area. And maybe 50 or so of the prostration boards, and people. And people come and go, but basically all day there's always 20 to 50 people just continuously prostrating towards the stupa. And they'll sometimes put a little Buddha or something at the end of their board, but the stupa itself is just looming above as those eyes. There's eyes on all the sides, so everywhere you look up, it's like these serene Buddha eyes are kind of like looking down on you. And then in a bowing area, well, some people are bowing and they're reciting their own sutras and so on. And there'd be groups of people like I'm doing service together. They'd gather in a circle and all chant something for an hour or so. So that's the like life at the stupa. And it's just kind of open. It's nobody's kind of in charge. I mean, they do lock it at night and open it in the morning. And there's a little shrine area that's like the, you know, the a little bit of like a tiny sort of little hall where they actually are doing ritual, chanting with drums and so on throughout the day. Sometimes with like food offering things, and they'll have this kind of roped off area where, I don't know even how it works or where this comes from, but you just see these mounds, like a 5 foot high mound of like, you know, candy bars and all kinds of food and just rice just poured all over it, just heaps and heaps of stuff, basically offerings that I think the food would eventually get distributed to at the end of the offering to the numerous homeless beggars and in the area. So you just have this, maybe you can get the sense of it's just this awesome display of devotion. And again, you don't really know what's going on in people's minds. And for them, it's just like their daily routine. But you even see it like out on the streets, there's little shrines everywhere, people putting a red paste on the stone statues. Sometimes the paste is so covering the stone that you don't even know what deity it is. It's just a mound of red lump of offering paste. So a little different sense of aesthetics, you know. They build these beautiful things, but then you often end up beautiful golden statue, but you only see this tiny little head because it's covered with robes and cloths and beads and food, and it's a kind of like a different way of thinking about things. It's like it's set up and then you just go wild with a kind of like offering thing. And I wonder about it, you know, because we do a lot, we do offerings here, right? But we maybe don't take it to that level. And I think it's interesting for us because, at this Zen Center, we do a lot of offering ceremonies and things, so it might seem strange to newcomers, but we get used to it. And then there's some feeling behind it. We get used to it, and there's a heart that's doing it. I think at first seeing this thing, it can seem so alien, like, what are these people doing? Like, what's the point? And is this Buddhist practice? Like, is this what the Buddha didn't teach this kind of thing, did he? He just said, go under a tree and meditate. These people may have never even done any just silent meditation. So it's a different way of thinking about practice, but I think there's some authentic practice elements. There can be. to such types of activities. Sometimes they talk about making offerings as the accumulation of merit, and then the insight into the nature of reality is like accumulation of wisdom. And to be a Buddha, we need both, like the accumulation of merit and wisdom both need to be completely fulfilled. We talk about the six paramitas, the six perfections of giving and ethical conduct and patience and diligence and meditative concentration. Sometimes those are all called the accumulation of merit. And then prajnaparamita, the six, the perfection of wisdom is the accumulation of wisdom. So they work together. We might also wonder, well, all this energy people are putting into this, wouldn't it be good to just, you know, go help some people? Or if all this energy to make offerings and buy all this stuff, what about just feeding the poor? And I think people do feed the poor too. But I think that's an interesting question for rationally minded Westerners. It's like, what's the, you know, so much energy into this? Is there, what's the function behind it? Is it really helpful? And or is it just superstitious? Like, who are these deities and beings that are they really receiving these offerings? So I think naturally, for me, these kinds of questions come up. Even though I'm immersed in it myself, I like to stop and ask. Not just do it blindly or by rote or, well, it's just because it's what you do. But what is, what's behind it? And I think it's like, it's an inner attitude. It's the mind that's actually, could even say, what's accumulation of merit anyway? It's a kind of letting go of self. Of course, giving the first paramita, as most of these practices could be seen as types of giving and giving to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And the merit that's accumulated, you could say, is just like, is the kind of an energetic result of giving oneself away. Maybe we could say it like that. Like an energetic result, the resultant energy of some practice of giving oneself away. So I think if we're doing it but we're kind of holding back or we don't really feel it as giving, then maybe it's still, there's teachings that would still say there still is some merit because you're actually doing it. But I think it's that inner heart of like, I just love making offerings to Buddhas and feeling that like. And in a way, I think it's kind of nice when it, because it doesn't really have a rational function. Sometimes I'm like, well, here I have 5 or 10 rupees, it's like 5 or 10 cents. And so sometimes I give it to the beggar and sometimes in the donation box in the temple. And like, but is that really going to help anybody? They're just going to use it to like buy more butter lamps or something. You know, it's not like they're using it to maintain a place for people to practice exactly because the places are pretty run down. They don't keep the buildings maybe so well, but they really keep the offerings flowing. So that's where it's probably going to go. And is that so helpful? And I think sometimes it would feel like, yeah, partly because it doesn't make so much sense. Like, oh, this is good. This really helps this person. And this, I'm going to go buy like 100 candles and put them all around the stupa. That's totally ridiculous. But sometimes it would feel like just the thing to do. Partly for that sense of giving oneself away, because there's this little part of the mind that goes, that's really stupid and useless. That's a waste of money. Of course, there's people doing it all around, right? Really poor people actually giving a lot to candles and incense and stuff. So sometimes for me, it would be more like giving than giving to the homeless person who's, you know, maybe helps them a little bit. They're making a lot anyway too. And if I give to them, it kind of, I can rationalize it. Oh yeah, that feels really good. I helped that person. Maybe they'll get something to eat. It's kind of, it gives a little bit more back to myself. Whereas just putting candles on a stupa doesn't feel like it gives anything back to me. I don't feel like it's necessarily like that was a good thing. Even like I accumulated merit, I can't even quite get behind that so much. So it's almost more, sometimes for me it would feel even more like giving up myself or my ideas of what makes sense. So partly what was inspiring to me was that these were just kind of like regular people in their daily lives doing these kind of things, and I think if there is some benefit to it, are there things that we can do or maybe are doing here in our culture? It's like we have such a different culture, but I think because we don't have those elements, how can we cultivate that spirit, almost like a little bit crazy spirit of just doing things that don't make sense, but that actually the heart feels open anyway. So, you know, an obvious one is because we don't have all these stupas around Santa Cruz and temples and every block and at every street corner. Eventually, maybe we could start, you know, we could start building them. But for now, it's like in our own homes, you can set up an altar, and I'm sure many people have, you know, a Buddha or something. I think in our culture, often we have like a Buddha image or a picture, and sometimes we treat it more like art. Like it's a beautiful thing, and we put it somewhere, and it reminds us, you know, especially if it's good art. As an artist myself, I really appreciate great Buddhist art, and figures of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are, sometimes you look at them and they're just like, you just calm down by seeing their face if they're created really well. But there's another kind of step that's possible to do, is like you have a home altar or an area that's like Buddhas or Bodhisattvas, but then you can actually make offerings to them. I think that's the that's what makes a kind of art inspiration corner different from an altar or a practice around it, is you relate to it. I mean, an offering could be just bowing to it, but also it could be incense or food or water, other, you know, traditional ones, but anything that you like and that Buddhas might like. So I've done such practices for a long time, and I'm thinking about this talk to it because I'm doing them today, throughout the day. I think I want to really recommit myself to not do them in a kind of like sort of mindless way, not to just by rote, well, it's time to do this little ceremony. I mean, even here, we'll offer incense all the time, to not be like, well, that's what we do before Zazen, is we put a stick of fragrance up there. It's more like, no, no, this is like making an offering to Buddhas before we sit. It's just a different kind of mind. It's very easy when we do things regularly to just start doing them kind of habitually. So another one you can do if you have a home altar is when you eat, you can make a food offering. That's done in the Zen monasteries for all the meals. But I like to do before breakfast and lunch. You know, you can look at it as a kind of cute thing of like, ah, you like put a little food for the statue. But another way to think of it is like, you know, we like eating, right? So it's like, oh, here we got the meal already, and like, ready to dig in. But like, wait, before we do that, this thing that I'm going to delight in this meal, like, first, let's think of Buddha. And Buddha, do we mean like the founder of Buddha Dharma in India, because he's the one who brought us these teachings that are so helpful to us, and so we're grateful to him? I think, yeah, we include that. And also all Buddhas in 10 directions and 3 times, all awakened beings and bodhisattvas on the path, and all the Zen ancestors and the Dharma protectors, and basically any kind of energetic helpfulness and inspiration to us. It's kind of like, before I kind of enjoy my own meal, it's just a chance to stop and, oh yeah, it's first, you know, it's a kind of giving oneself away, right? A little one, it's just a little one. I'm going to eat and enjoy it myself and forget all about Buddha in a minute anyway, but just before I do. And, you know, meal chant is kind of like that too. Like, oh, remembering why we're eating here, and we offer in the meal chant, we say this food is for the 3 treasures, for our teachers, family, and all beings. Sometimes if you don't have time to do the whole meal chant, or you're with a group of people and you don't want to, it's not appropriate to do it out loud, sometimes just to myself, just that for me, that's the heart of it, because that's the offering. Before I eat, this food is for the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So I think there's lots of things we can do in our daily lives to kind of like just remind us of practice. And of course there's all the traditional ways, and the traditional ones are nice because we can sometimes feel like we're being supported, and we're kind of joining all these other people who are doing the same things throughout space and time. But that's, I think, not as important as just, you know, we could make it up ourselves, make up a modern form of doing the same activity, not so rational, but that kind of heart offering. So that's some thoughts I had coming back from Nepal. Less about meditate. I mean, we had this meditation retreat, but really, what was most impactful for me was the kind of this expression of devotion, ritual devotion, and it's a body thing. I think that's part of it too. Is that as kind of rational, Western, scientific-oriented people, we're like, we can just get into the thought of, you know, mind training and understanding Dharma like that. And even the feeling of like, well, generosity means just like, notice your feeling of generosity or not. But these practices are like, it is about the feeling, but it's also about physically and verbally, like, enacting something. Both for our, it, you know, it trains the body, speech, and mind. And like for me, these people, whatever was going on in their mind, to me, that was like this huge reminder. When you come to the stupa at rush hour, whoa! Thousands of people just walking around Buddha, is like whatever I was thinking about, whatever kind of self-engrossed thoughts I had before I turned that corner, like, oh yeah, whatever is happening there is like, let's remember what's most important. Yeah, any thoughts or questions?
Your whole talk, I was thinking of Shantideva saying, away meaningless greens through everybody, and in the end you can just give your life.
You start with meaningless greens?
Yeah, just give things away mm-hmm. To get into the habit.
To get into the habit, exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Just do it.
It is like, it's like a training, right? It's, and I think sometimes we have to do it at first. It feels funny, especially like these, you know, Buddhist rituals of incense to statues and things. It takes, I think we have to go through a phase where it's like, especially if you're doing it alone at home, maybe for the first time, it's like, this is the biggest trip ever. Like, what is this all about? This is just, you know, come off it. But then, you know, over and over again, until then you start to like gradually, the heart feeling behind it is there, and then here's the incense, and now it's like, oh, Buddha, I want to give Buddha everything. Yeah, starting with just a few greens. I really enjoy the fact that we do these kind of things here, that we have service, and we make it optional. So if it's like, we just want to sit and go, but service is basically, in the Tibetan monasteries, that's what they're doing all the time. All the same elements that we do with offerings, bowing, chanting, and kind of group celebration of Buddha, accumulation of positive energy, giving oneself away. Sometimes, you know, it seems like, well, the Tibetans are really into this kind of stuff, and Zen, we just sit, you know, but especially in the Japanese monasteries, it's like usually there's more of this kind of devotional offering activity than there is Zazen. A lot of, maybe most places. I think it's a good mix. I think they maybe could use a little more silent sitting in it over there. But I thought in our tradition, you know, we have this, Dogen has this Shobo Genzo essay called Making Offerings to Buddhas, Kuyo Shobutsu. Just briefly, you become Buddhas by the merit of making offerings to Buddhas. How can a sentient being who has not made offerings to even one Buddha become a Buddha? There is no becoming a Buddha without cause. And the cause here is making offerings to Buddhas. And then it's quite an interesting fascicle. Later in Dogen's life, near the end of this is the 88th chronological essay out of 95. Dogen's quoting all these sutras about Shakyamuni Buddha saying in all these past lives he made these offerings to Buddhas, but he never got a prediction of enlightenment because he always made the offerings with a grasping mind. And we don't know if the grasping mind means he was holding back a little on the offerings, like, maybe this is stupid and like I could use this, you know, these offerings for myself or for somebody who's going to actually eat them or something. Or maybe grasping at his own merit accumulation. So over and over again, it goes on and on in all these different generations with different Buddhas. He kept having a grasping mind, and finally he didn't. And then somebody said, oh, you're going to become a Buddha. And the Lotus Sutra, Dogen's favorite sutra, says, if you venerate and make offerings of flowers, incense, banners, and canopies to a painted image of the Buddha, in a stupa and make exquisite sounds with drums, horns, and flutes, and praise the Buddha's virtues by singing with joy. Even with a scattered mind, if you make offerings of a flower to a painted image of the Buddha, you will immediately see countless Buddhas. So, that's in the Lotus Sutra. But then he quotes Nagarjuna's Perfection of Wisdom treatise, and this story of when the Buddha was in the world, there was a blind monk. Without seeing, he used his hands to sew a robe. But when the thread came off from the needle, he said to himself, "Who's going to benefit me by threading the needle for me?" And Shakyamuni Buddha went to him, to this blind monk, and said, "I love beneficial merit. Let me thread the needle for you." Noticing that it was the Buddha's voice, the blind monk quickly put on his robe, bowed at the Buddha's feet, and said, "Well, the Buddha's already complete with merit. You've completed the accumulation of merit. How come you say you love beneficial merit?" And the Buddha said, "Although I am already complete with merit, I deeply understand the cause, effect, and power of merit. The reason why I excel most among all sentient beings is because of this merit. Therefore, I love beneficial merit. I'll thread the needle for you." And the one time somebody bows to the Buddha, and the world honored one, the Buddha smiles, and the monks around him said, "Why do you smile, Buddha?" And the Buddha said, "That Brahmin who just bowed to me actually just bowed to two world-honored ones. Just bowed to two Buddhas." The monk said, "Why two Buddhas?" The Buddha said, "When he bowed to me, there was a stupa of Kashyapa Buddha below his cane under the ground." Maybe it was that Kathmandu Kashyapa Buddha stupa. But maybe there's many Kashyapa Buddha stupas. Buddha said, "Go ahead, look under the ground." So they dug it up and they found the stupa. And the Buddha's like, "Let's build some more stupas to Kashyapa Buddha." And then Dogen goes into like basically pages of instructions on the way to construct authentic stupas. So, we know we have other building projects coming up here, but eventually... let's build a stupa in the back garden. A small one. Like 7 yojanas in length. Reaching above the heaven of the 33. And then he talks about all the different kinds of offerings with the different hearts of offering. Offerings should always be made with a sincere heart. This is what Buddhas have practiced. Guidelines for enshrining Buddha images and relics, venerating and bowing, as well as building stupas, have been authentically transmitted in the house of Buddha ancestors alone. If the guidelines are not authentically transmitted, there will be discrepancies. And if there are discrepancies, offerings will not be genuine. And if the offerings are not genuine, there's no merit. So, please learn how to correctly make offerings. Zen master Ling Dao spent years attending to the tomb of Hui Nong, the sixth ancestor. Worker Lu, Hui Nong himself, pounded rice ceaselessly for the assembly of monks day and night. These were both appropriate ways of making offerings. These examples are a few out of many that are impossible to list. So we have a whole new year of practice, and we can can make many offerings, seen and unseen, to Buddhas, to each other, to the whole world. Give ourselves away again and again. Give up all ideas of any lack. Therefore, there's infinite possibility of giving. And lastly, I just want to mention a new Zen Center offering this year. We have this program called Warming the Jewel, many people know, where it's like a year-long commitment to practice, come to the temple, come to Zen Center and practice. And a lot of people's schedules and life circumstances make it impossible to do all those things on that schedule. But people really appreciate coming together and having monthly meetings to talk about practice. So another thing we're going to try this year, starting soon, is another type of like kind of group practice commitment, but that doesn't involve having to come to the Zen Center all the time. So for people who've been interested in that kind of thing, but they're like, I can't come like 5 times a week to the Zen Center, but I'd like to have a kind of chance to study Dharma together and so on. We'll have a kind of self-designed practice where you kind of like to help encourage people to practice. If you want to take up, you can kind of like think, well, how do I want to practice this year? And then together we can kind of work out whatever works for you. And then we'll come together once a month and study something. And also maybe more a good chance if people want to kind of like learn the Buddha's teachings in a more maybe methodical way. I thought we could start with the early teachings and the foundational teachings of the Buddha in the early sutras, and maybe kind of study at home and then come together and talk about. So I sent an email already to a bunch of people, but if you didn't get that and you might be interested, let me know and I'll send out soon, and maybe when the practice period starts, we'll start that year. And any other suggestions people have for this year, this new year of practice, and what would be encouraging to you, please let me know. We can do anything. We can even build a stupa. It's good to see you all again. Be here in this way. We dedicate any merit accumulated from discussing Dharma and contemplating giving ourselves away. We give the merit away. We dedicate it to all beings, and especially those greatly suffering. May they all find their way to ease and joy, freedom and peace. Beings are numberless.